This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
There are no words that can possibly atone for what I have done. Know that I am sorry nonetheless. You have done nothing to deserve the pain that I have caused. My actions were nothing short of irreprehensible. I do not expect forgiveness for my actions, and I will regret them every day for the rest of my life.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
I don't really think that sorry cuts it in this case. Let me tell you, the case of Peter Manfredonia is one that chills you to the bone because it demonstrates the fact that as human beings, we're walking around and we are completely unaware of what's going on beneath the surface of some people's mindsets, psyches and actions. We genuinely have no idea of their capacity or capability for evil. But the case of Peter Manfredonia really does highlight this for a whole host of reasons, because he was somebody that absolutely nobody believed had the capacity for what actually plays out in what I'm going to tell you today. It is breathtakingly dreadful what he does. And yet it feels as if nobody was prepared for that ever being possible. Peter was only 23 years of age at the time that he carried out his crime, and it is one that is mind-blowing. Let's kick off with today's true crime case and go into detail on these heinous attacks that occurred at the hands of Peter Manfredonia. So he was 23, like I said, at the time. He was born on February the 2nd, 1997. He was born in Sandy Hook, Newtown. I know that many of you will immediately think, oh, Sandy Hook, that rings a bell. His mother was Jeanette Manfredonia. She was a really well-respected, outstanding science teacher at Newtown High School. His father was Robert Manfredonia. Now, he grew up in the Sandy Hook section of Newtown on Yogananda Street. He was described by people who knew him as a big athletic kid. Apparently his life just really revolved around sports from a really young age. He had the height for sports without a shadow of a doubt. And unbelievably, he literally lived six houses down the block from mass murderer Adam Lanza. Like I said, when I said Sandy Hook, I know a lot of your ears will have pricked up. Now, Adam Lanza, he was somebody who on December the 14th, 2012, at 20 years of age, shot his mother, then went to his old school where he shot and killed 26 people. This is before he actually shot himself in the head. The victims were 20 children between the ages of 6 and 7 years of age. He also killed 6 adult members of staff at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Absolutely tragic beyond measure. And let's be honest, in Sandy Hook area, it affected so many people. In fact, a resident said, until you spend time in Sandy Hook, you don't understand how it affects people, because there is not a single person who doesn't know somebody who's lost a loved one. So this is something that just massively impacted the area. And he was growing up in that area. Now, bear in mind, he was also 15 years of age at the time of those killings. So that's quite an impressionable age. And it has been speculated as to whether it had an impact on his future choices. I would say no, unless you're saying that this gave him a permission base. I don't think the trauma of living in an area like Sandy Hook is going to make you have a predisposition to go ahead and carry out a similar attack or an attack on anyone of any nature. In fact, you would imagine it would do the entire contrary. You would imagine that you would grow up compassionate and understanding, and you would have seen the fallout and collateral damage and the agony that Adam Lanza caused. It wouldn't spur you on to think, well, maybe I will go and harm somebody as well. Now, I have to acknowledge that at the time of Sandy Hook, And at the time of him being 15 years of age, his parents are also getting divorced. So that is a trauma. That's very destabilizing. At 15 years of age, you've got used to your life with your parents, and it's a big shock, even if they've had a fractious relationship, when they decide to separate. So that will cause a fracture in his foundation. Also, at that point, he was beginning his sophomore year in high school, so big changes, and his family was basically falling apart whilst he was dealing with the fallout of what happened at Sandy Hook. And this means that to some degree it will have been a turbulent time. Would that be a reason to end up carrying out traumatic killings? No, I don't believe so for a minute. And by 2013, his mother...
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Father actually has sole possession of the family home, and he lived there with his two sisters. So even though there's been a destabilization within his life regarding the divorce and the events that happened at Sandy Hook, he has got the stability of his home address. So he's not had to move somewhere else. So that will have given him at least a level of foundation that's familiar. Now, Manfredonia was a senior of the University of Connecticut. He was actually known as an absolute model student. He was really bright. He was enrolled in the University of Connecticut's Management and Engineering for Manufacturing program. He was on the honor roll, or the high honor roll. So he didn't struggle academically at all. He was 6'3". He weighed 240 pounds, he's a big guy, and understandably, because of his interest and prowess in sport, his name could often be found in the sports pages as a captain on the Newtown High School track and field team, or as an offensive lineman for the 2013 conference champion football team. And at his graduation, he literally won the Outstanding Male Athlete Award in 2015. So these are things that should highlight a trajectory that's going to be amazing. Everything is going in his favor, from his sporting prowess to his academic prowess. He's had some bumps in the road, but certainly everything seems like he should be living a positive pro-social life, because he's been benefited with certain traits that enable him to do well in sport, and also his intellect. Now, he's then accepted to UConn. This is where he enrolled in the honours programme studying management and engineering. He became a senior by 2020. Another thing that stands out and is ironic in this case, which will become clear as I talk about it, Manfredonia was a critic for gun violence. He was a supporter of the Sandy Hook Promise organisation. So this is a non-profit charity, aims to help prevent gun violence towards children, rightfully so, when you've suffered such a horrendous attack as Sandy Hook. He actually participated in a 2019 athletic fundraising event and selected them, that particular non-profit, as a beneficiary. And he made numerous posts to social media accounts just talking about his anti-firearm views. In fact, one stated this: "It is sad to think that any child should have to feel unsafe in a school. It is sad to think that hundreds more will also no longer be able to walk the halls of the schools in which they were brought up. It is sad to think that we have stood idly by and done nothing, as innocent people continue to die at the hands of those who would only seek to inflict pain in this world. No longer are these shootings isolated incidents. They are an epidemic plaguing this great country where we live." Now, to say that's ironic is an understatement in this case. And like I said, that will become clear. And I suppose behind the picture of this person painting themselves as an absolute pacifist, behind this undoubtedly dedicated student, there were things going on in the background, behind closed doors, that people could not have been aware of. First of all, he'd had issues with his mental health. He'd battled with depression and anxiety for years before the crime that I'm going to talk about. Let's be clear, though. People with anxiety and depression don't routinely kill people. In fact, the one thing that we are concerned about when people have high-level depression or anxiety is they might harm themselves. They're not a threat to other people. So that doesn't wash with me at all. He did seek to go to a therapist at some point, but when people found out that he had sought therapy, they were actually really surprised, because He didn't present in a way that people felt he was struggling, but then so many people with depression, anxiety, mental health issues, they do mask the way they truly feel. So that's not unusual. His landlord actually described him as a normal guy. And the classmates who were interviewed about what he was like, they said, you know, he was always smiling. He always seemed to be happy because he was competing in his sport bouts. However, I suppose you could say that there were some things on the walls of his bedroom in an off-campus apartment that had some questions that you could ask about them. So there were writings on his wall saying things like, I'm not angry, I'm upset. Welcome to Peter World. Is this bad? Will I get in trouble? Will they look at me strange? Now, people write things like this all the time. That certainly doesn't indicate that somebody is about to do something terrible to other human beings. But you can see that there was some upset that was going on beneath the surface. Obviously, many people internalize that. That's why they write things about themselves, because they're kind of putting on paper their feelings about how they feel about the way that they look or the way that they are in their lives or the successes or failures. Others externalize. So they may do things to deal with the rage inside by taking it out on other people. Everyone is different. But certainly, you can see that those musings, those writings suggest that there is something going on within. But like I said, he's masking to the world around him that everything's okay. Now, he later told the police when he was interviewed after the crime that in the months leading up to it, he felt that his mental health had genuinely worsened. And he also said at times he was in a manic state. But again, lots of us will know people, and some of us will be people, who've gone through periods of mania. You don't go out and kill people.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
That's not in line with the reality of that kind of classified mental illness. So what actually happened in this case, which is just mind-blowing when you think about the person I've just described so far, is that at 9 a.m. on Friday, the 22nd of May, 2020, calls start coming in to 911 from Myrtle Road, reporting that two men are down. A 62-year-old man named Ted Demers, he'd basically just done what a good, decent human being would do. He sees the young man by the side of the road, sees as far as he is concerned, he's got a broken down motorbike, and so he pulls over and says, look, do you want a lift? For that, he gets horrifically attacked by the rider of that motorbike, and the rider of that motorbike is Manfredonia. And the way he gets attacked is absolutely horrifying, because Manfredonia is armed with a samurai sword. Now, I appreciate you will all know what a samurai sword is, and can you imagine the damage that would be inflicted on an unsuspecting member of the public who's not prepared for any kind of attack whatsoever? And then a neighbour, a guy called John Franco, actually sees this playing out and attempts to intervene because he's a hero, clearly. But again, he's horribly injured at the scene. Now, at this point, Manfredonia gets back on the motorbike, flees the scene. And of course, this means that law enforcement can't catch him at that moment in time because they're attending to the severely injured people. They don't quite know who has carried out this attack. Now, both of the men were severely injured. Clearly, samurai attack is going to do that. And very sadly, Demers succumbed to the injuries. Now, Franco, he survived, but he had to have multiple surgeries and lots of rehabilitation. And the witness who called 911, they reported that they saw two men bleeding profusely and that one of the victims was missing a hand. And you can imagine that, can't you, with an offensive wound. If somebody puts the hand up and the samurai sword comes down, you are going to lose your hand. Now, the investigators who came to the scene of the attack on Myrtle Road, they actually found a samurai sword in a wooded area that was quite close by. They also noticed that the sword was bent. So imagine the force that were used for it to be bent, and also it appeared at the time to have blood on it. Now, the police also locate Manfredonia's cell phone and his driver's license, and that seems very suspicious that those things are there. Of course, they could be looking for another victim, because Manfredonia could have been a victim, couldn't they? But it means that they've got a name now. And then a short time later, they actually locate a red Kawasaki motorcycle, which has been abandoned on Old Town Road in Willington. Now, at this point, they also discover a white helmet and a t-shirt with Chinese lettering that translated to world peace. I kid you not. World peace when these kind of attacks have just been carried out. Also, it appears to have been rinsed in a stream, so somebody's tried to get rid of potentially blood off it. But how ironic that a perpetrator is wearing something that translated says world peace when he's just taken a samurai sword to two people, one of which had literally just stopped to try to help him and give him a lift somewhere. Now, a search later on Manfredonia's apartment uncovered a box of shirts, and they were identical to each other, and they all contained the same design as the t-shirt found by the stream. And when investigators were interviewing certain people who knew him, one of the witnesses said that she'd actually stopped seeing Manfredonia because she'd found out that he'd been attempting to hack into her social media accounts the week before the crime was committed, and it just disturbed her, so she withdrew contact from him. But one of the things that they're able to find pretty quickly is that motorcycle is registered to Peter Manfredonia. Now, during the investigation, a witness who knew him said, listen, this guy was absolutely obsessed with samurai swords. So at this point, the police know he is going to be the prime suspect. So the search is basically on to find him. He's possibly armed. He's certainly dangerous. They need to locate him as quickly as possible. Because bear in mind, this is completely out of the blue. He's not been on the authorities' radar. So this is completely blindsiding for investigators that this individual is potentially going on a killing rampage. And he's already killed one person and seriously injured another. That means that he certainly has the potential to do the same elsewhere. Now, in the early hours after that initial attack, it's around 5:15 a.m, Saturday, May the 23rd, a nearby 73-year-old homeowner, I've not got the name of that individual, it isn't in the press, but they wake up and there is a person pressing a gun to his head. So that's what he comes around to. Can you imagine the absolute horror? You wake up and it's the early hours of the morning, you're kind of coming out of that sleep state. You don't know whether you're having some kind of nightmare and you realise you're waking to an actual living nightmare, and there is a stranger pressing a gun to your head saying, don't turn around, I'll blow your head off. Now, initially, that intruder called himself Rick. Now, he then gets the guy up, zip ties him, tapes him to a chair in the basement, and at this point, Manfredonia weirdly puts a movie on. And then he actually asked the victim, what do you like to watch on TV? He then casually shaved, he ate, and he remained in that house throughout the day. Now, that victim later recalled to the police that the individual who came in was a young white man in his early 20s. He was dressed in a black t-shirt, black sweatpants, and he appeared soiled, like he'd been in the woods. Also, he noted that he was barefoot. And he said there was a strangeness about the way he presented. He had this blank, distant stare, and that was something that stuck with him. Now, bear in mind, this victim's very clever, because when you are in a situation like that where somebody is basically holding your life in their hands, shall we say, you want to make yourself as human as possible. You want to make it as personal as possible. It's more challenging for people to hurt people that have got a rapport with them to some degree. It's why when you hear about these investigations where they bring a negotiator because they want to get the negotiator to build a relationship so that the individual will give themselves up, personal rapport is really powerful and really important. And this victim gets that. So he tries to make conversation with him. And then clearly the television is on and the news report comes on the TV, and at that point he admits that he is the person wanted on television. So now you've got that victim thinking, oh my God, there is a killer in my home, and that must have been absolutely horrifying. Now, that victim actually said, I asked if he wanted to talk about what took place with the murder, and he told me he hadn't slept for 5 days and he just flipped. He said he didn't know why he did it, He also said he was remorseful for it. And the victim said he also got him to talk about himself and his family. And he said, strangely, Manfredonia smiled when he talked about motorcycles. And he also made it clear to that victim that he wasn't intending to turn himself in. Now, at that point, you can imagine that victim is thinking to themselves, am I going to get out of this alive? Because he doesn't want to turn himself in. He's in my home. I may be seen as collateral that's worth damaging. And at the end of the day, he doesn't want to be identified. And I know exactly what he looks like. And even though his face would have been put into every single home all over the States, it doesn't matter. Because it's the perpetrator's perception of the situation that counts. And he could well have thought to himself, I want to get rid of this particular witness, particularly a witness that I've carried out a crime towards, which additionalizes the charges that I'd be facing in court. Now, Manfredonia then makes dinner for himself. And this must have been so strange for this particular kidnap victim.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
And he even offered at that point to make some food for the victim, but let's just throw it out there. I don't know. I think if I was zip-tied and taped to a chair in my basement with a known killer and they offered to make me some food, I probably wouldn't have an appetite. And obviously the victim doesn't have an appetite, but he did get the victim a drink of water. And the reason for that was he had some medication that he needed to take. And so he actually went ahead and got that for the victim. So really strange dichotomy, isn't it? You've got this killer on one level, and then you've got this guy who's seeming more humane, even though this horrendous perpetrator and killer helping this person take his medication. And I think that that building of rapport and the asking for help as well, i.e. could you get my medication, is really helpful. Because what we know psychologically is you are more likely to be favourable to somebody that you help. It's really bizarre. If you want somebody to like you more, ask them to help you. We know psychologically that has an impact. Now, before dawn on Sunday, May the 24th, Manfredonia ends up tightening the bindings on his victim and basically warns the victim not to move. Tells him, if you stay still, if you make no reports by 10 a.m, I promise you, I will tell the authorities where you are, that you're down in your basement, so they'll come and rescue you. He then stole the man's Ford F-150 along with several firearms and took off. So now he's very heavily weaponized and he has a vehicle. Now at 6:45 a.m. on the 24th, that stolen F-150 is located near Osbornsdale State Park in Derby. Basically, it was involved in a minor accident. For the grace of God, it was involved in a minor accident, because then this is how the investigators end up getting led toward an apartment on Roosevelt Drive. So police, they trace Manfredonia's movements from the park to the residence using surveillance footage. Now it also led them to track back to the home of the vehicle owner, thank God. At this point, they force entry into the home. They find him zip-tied and taped up, and this means obviously he's cut loose, and this means that he's okay, thank God. But inside the Roosevelt apartment, it's a completely different story. And I'm sure one that the officers had no idea they were going to walk into. They walk into an utterly devastating sight. Another victim who's dead. That victim was 23-year-old Nicholas J. Izeal. He was a Newtown High classmate of Manfredonia. And it appeared that he'd been killed with a single gunshot. But his girlfriend, who was meant to be present, who lived with him, Shannon Spies, she wasn't there. So Izeal's girlfriend had literally been abducted from the apartment. So Nicholas's girlfriend is nowhere to be seen. You can imagine they're thinking to themselves, well, he's dead. We know this guy's responsible for another murder as well and severely wounding another human being. He's taken somebody else, basically prisoner, for a whole day. What on earth is going to have happened to this young woman? And also, knowing that she's been taken and she's likely witnessed the murder of her boyfriend, isn't she going to be a problem as well when it comes down to his idea about whether she should live or die? So time is ticking. And finding her alive is something that they were probably doubting at that first instance. Now, fortunately, by some miracle, later that very same day, police do manage to find her. She's unharmed, traumatised, yes. She's near her vehicle. It's a black 2016 Volkswagen Jetta. She then tells that terrifying story. She says she was kidnapped by the same man that she had seen fire 3 rounds into her boyfriend. So he'd been shot 3 times. So she had witnessed the death of her boyfriend. And as the authorities thought, it was Peter Manfredoni who'd carried out that attack. Now, after she had witnessed this, which just must have been breathtakingly horrific for her, bear in mind, you know, put yourself in the position. You love someone. You have no idea that this is about to play out. You know, you've got to put yourself in that position where you're sat in your home. The door goes, you answer it. And the next minute, your partner's been shot 3 times. You've got a gun to your head. You're being forced to your car. You're being made to drive him somewhere, which is exactly what happened. She basically was forced to drop him off at a New Jersey truck stop near the Pennsylvania border. And all the way, she'd be thinking to herself, he's going to kill me. He's going to probably harm me before killing me as well, because she's female and you're going to have that mindset. And she's also managing the grief of what she's just seen. The man that she loves, dead, shot in front of her. You can't even begin to compute the emotional burden and trauma and fallout of that experience. And yes, she survived, but the scars must run deep for her. Now, apparently, after she's dropped him there, he then tries to hail an Uber, but the driver actually recognises him from the news, immediately reports and calls 911, says, I've seen this guy, and bear in mind, he is on the run and he's still armed at this point. However, what happens is he does manage to find another driver that will take him to an East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania Walmart. So he has managed to flee from that scene. Now, the next day, this is May 25th, another vehicle at this point is reported missing from near this Walmart. So obviously they know that he's gone around that area. This is a 2012 black Hyundai Santa Fe. Now, over the next few days, Manfredonia is still on the run, so he's evading capture, and he's armed, and he's dangerous, and he's killed people, multiple people. So the investigators are desperate. They're scanning surveillance footage. They're just desperate to track him down, and finally they do find the footage of him stealing the SUV. Now, at some point after he's taken that SUV, he ends up getting another ride to Hagerstown, Maryland. Now, at this point, the big boys are all involved. There's a fugitive task force, including Maryland State Police, US Marshals, Connecticut State Police, and the FBI. And they managed to narrow his location down, so they knew kind of where they were expecting him to be, and they were putting forces in all of the areas that he might turn up. Now, around 9 p.m. in Hagerstown, Maryland, Manfredonia is found. Finally, bear in mind, he's a big guy, he's a tall guy, so he's going to stand out. And they'd spotted this tall man emerging from woods behind the Pilot Travel Centre on Halfway Boulevard. At this point, they do confront him, and he does actually surrender without any incident. He then walked officers to a bag. That bag contained a handgun, and they believe that handgun tied him to the Derby homicide. Now, Maryland State Police, they arrest him just after 9 p.m. They then hold him pending extradition, and he was arrested on charges of murder, criminal attempt to commit murder, assault in the first degree, home invasion, kidnapping with a firearm in the first degree, robbery in the first degree, larceny in the first degree, and stealing a firearm, 2 counts of that, and also assault on an elderly party, 3rd degree. Now, Manfredonia is taken in for questioning at this point because I guess that people were just sitting there thinking, what has happened? What has gone on for this guy that many would have considered a gentle giant to carry out 2 homicides and so many more crimes out of nowhere? Now, when Manfredonia is taken in for questioning, everybody has got so many because how on earth has this happened? How is this mild-mannered, some would say gentle giant gone from being considered a sporting hero to some degree, an academic, successful student, to an absolute monster. What has played out? What's changed? And you can imagine the detectives want to get to the root cause of that. Is this somebody who didn't know what they were doing? Have they had some kind of psychotic break? Or do they have a reasoning behind their actions? So during this questioning, he basically says, look, I've been suicidal, I've been depressed, I've been binge eating.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
None of which is going to evidence why he's done what he's done. I mean, first of all, if you have suicidal ideation, which is horrific, you think about ending your own life. You don't think about ending everybody else's life. Quite the contrary, your fixation is on you are not worthy and you don't want to be here anymore. You don't think about harming others. In fact, people with suicidal ideation tend to be incredibly compassionate, empathic, sensitive, caring human beings that feel burdened by not being good enough or burdened by their anxieties within the world. They aren't going around shooting people or stabbing people with samurai swords. And being depressed and binge eating certainly isn't something that's going to contribute to that. So he didn't internalize it by harming himself. He externalized it by harming other people. So the investigators then ask him about those drawings on his bedroom walls. And he basically says, look, I did them when I was in a manic period. But again, doesn't explain what he's done and the rampage that he's just caused of killing. Now, in the same interview, he did acknowledge being in Willington, that he'd hid in the woods. But the one thing he does refuse to do is to discuss what happened in Derby. In fact, he gave really evasive answers about how he even reached Maryland. So he's saying some things, but holding back a lot of information that is, of course, important and links in with the other crimes. Now, when it came down to his court appearances, initially on May the 28th, 2020, it happened in Washington County District Court. At this point, he actually waives his right for extradition. So that meant he arrives in Connecticut in mid-June. Then on June the 12th, 2020, he faced Rockville Superior Court. Now that was the venue for the Willington case. And at this particular court hearing, bond was set at a combined $7 million. So he wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't like he was going to get out. That was $5 million for homicide and $2 million for home invasion. And the judge also ordered at this point suicide watch, which basically means they check them every 15 minutes because they're at risk of taking their own life. So clearly there was a mental spiral happening. But there again, if you've been arrested for this kind of gravity of crime, I would understand that you would feel incredibly depressed about it. And very often people will think about evading justice by taking their own life. Now, at this point, the charges were murder, first degree assault, home invasion, plus related robbery and firearm counts tied to the overnight hostage incident after the first killing. Now, just days later, he also appears in Milford Superior Court for the Derby case. Here, prosecutors charge him with murder and also kidnapping in the first degree with a firearm, home invasion and robbery counts that was tied to the abduction that followed the murder of Nicholas, and two judicial districts, therefore, two benches and two state attorneys were involved in this case. So on July the 15th, 2020, he pled not guilty, which makes no sense. No, it doesn't make any sense. Anyway, he did. He said he was not guilty and he actually waived his probable cause hearing in the Rockville case. Now that's a standard move. It skips the evidentiary stage. And if you waive it, it basically means the defense don't want to lock witnesses into testimony that can help the prosecution refine its case. So instead, they're basically holding back. They're saving their leverage for negotiations. Now, more than 2.5 years after the crimes, this is on February the 8th, 2023, in Rockville, Peter Manfredonia stood before Judge Kathleen McNamara. Now, at this point, he changed his plea and he pled guilty to murder, assault in the first degree, and home invasion. Judge Kathleen said to Manfredonia, "You should never be released early. You're a danger to society." Then 1 week later, this is on February the 16th, 2023 in Milford, he stood before Judge Peter L. Brown. And then again, he pled guilty to murder and kidnapping in the first degree with a firearm. Now, his sentencing was received in 2 day back-to-back hearings in April of 2023. So it was the Derby case that went ahead first. And on April the 19th, families and friends of Nicholas spoke in open court. In fact, you can just see how loved he was. Every single one of them arrived wearing T-shirts with his face on, with a heart around it that read, "As long as I breathe, you will be remembered. Justice for Nick." And Nicholas's sister described Manfredonia as a monster who must be punished. Nicholas's father said he had so much life ahead of him. He hadn't even scratched the surface. And the prosecutor described it as a horrific crime that shattered so many people's lives. Now, of course, the defence attempted to argue his mental state was the reason behind it. His mental health was problematic at the time, but it just doesn't wash. He was able to carry out lots of tasks, including zip tying somebody to a chair and holding them hostage and going and getting them the medication. This does not speak of somebody who's out of their mind. It doesn't mean that somebody can't be unhappy. He clearly was unhappy with his life, but he wasn't out of his mind. He wasn't in a psychotic break. There was no defence there. And when it comes down to the judge, it was very clear that he agreed that he had many other choices to make in those moments and instead chose murderous ones. So he gave him a 55-year sentence. So 55 years for murder, also 25 years for the kidnapping. That was going to run at the same time. So it was concurrent as opposed to consecutive. So instead of getting 80 years, he just gets 55 years. Then the next day, which was April the 20th, the court in Rockville also sentenced him. So that was for the first homicide, the assault on the elderly neighbour and the home invasion. And the judge pronounced 55 years for murder, 20 years for first degree assault and 25 years for home invasion. Again, these were all to be served concurrently, so not consecutively. So basically a 55 year term. Now, under the plea, he did agree not to seek early release. So he agreed that he wasn't going to get parole or sentence modification. He'd have to serve that entire 55 years. And because of the guilty pleas, it meant that there was no trial. There was therefore no retracing of all the photographs and information that would have been highly traumatic for the family. And it meant there was no contested appeal, just two concurrent 55-year sentences. Some of you may feel that he should just have been given life without parole. I would imagine it will eventuate that it is life without parole, because at the end of the day, I would imagine that he probably may die in prison. And if he doesn't die in prison, should he get out, he'll be an incredibly old man. Now, just to say, we've not talked about the victims very much in this case, but let's just talk about Ted. Ted was a self-employed artisan furniture maker. He left behind his wife of 42 years, Cynthia Demers. Also, he left behind his two loving sons. He was described as an incredibly proud and an incredibly hard-working man, very gentle, very loving, incredibly gregarious, and a fighter. He'd actually had a 40-year battle with Crohn's disease. And with respect, that demonstrates his deep strength of character, his perseverance. And I'm going to be honest with you, this is the guy who did a neighbourly good thing. He pulled over because he thought somebody was broken down by the side of the road. What a compassionate, good man. And for that, he was murdered. His obituary read, "Ted was neighbourly, not just to his street, not just to his neighbours, but to the entire community of Willington." On a bright Friday morning in May, Ted was doing something he'd done a million times before and would have done a million times more if not for a simple and cruel twist of fate. He simply offered a hand to a stranger in need. For this good deed, his life was taken from him and his earthly presence from all of us. And it's so true. He did something so good nature-wise, and for that, he literally was killed with a samurai sword. He lived all his life, a good father, a good partner, a husband of all those years. And in one moment, for a good deed, he was dealt the cruelest blow. And the man who tried to save him, another hero, John Franco. He was a Navy veteran. He was in his 80s. And obviously, what an amazing human being. He served his country, and now he was serving a person in distress. Now, he survived catastrophic injuries. He had really bad head wounds and hand wounds. And his wife actually spoke to reporters and said he was a very lucky man, although I'm sure he didn't feel it at the time. Now, his recovery took lots of time. It had hospital and rehab periods, and his hand has been left permanently disabled. But what a hero, what an absolute hero. He was willing to risk his life for another human being. In his 80s as well. What a mark of a human being. Served his country, served his community. And yeah, got horribly injured. But what a mark of an incredible man. Nicholas, of course, a young 23-year-old man with everything to live for. He was remembered as a cheerful, quirky young man. Apparently, he loved abstract art and music. Apparently, he loved gardening. And also, he just started working alongside his dad because clearly they had an incredibly close relationship. His obituary reads, "For his entire life, the magnetism of Nick's love pulled people together. To him, his home was not complete without a few good friends. Nick had a passion for design and art. His style reflected his easygoing, unapologetic and free way of life. He had many skills, many talents, one of which was his impressive green thumb. After overcoming his own personal struggles, the end of his life was filled with his happiest days. Most of all, Nick is remembered by his awesome sense of humour, his gratitude and his heart of gold." What a beautiful testament. And I just want to say, because understandably, it's grotesquely sad that this young man died. It really is. It just is heartbreaking on every level. My son, my eldest son, is nearly 23. The idea of losing him, the idea of the rest of his future being stolen is just incomprehensible. It's almost impossible for me to think about it. I try to not think about those things because I just don't think I'd survive it. But there is just something so powerful in saying the end of his life was filled with his happiest days. There's something about taking the emphasis off the end, which I've talked about today. Of course, we're talking about the end of Nicholas's life, a life he was so entitled to. But by placing the emphasis on his happiness, it shows of a life fully loved and a life starting to be fully lived. And I think it's so powerful to do that because we so often get lost in the trauma and the tragedy and the darkness. And just that simple statement that is so profound and deep at the same time, it just highlights how powerful and important it is to remember that. I wish he had had more of his happiest days, but I am so glad that his family remember those. And it's so awful that the rest of his life was robbed. But I just really wanted to draw attention to that. You know, after overcoming his own personal struggles, the end of his life was filled with his happiest days. And whilst I am convinced he is surrounded in bliss now and will be reunited with all those who love him, I am glad that he had happy times before he lost his life. This case reminds us that we never quite know who we're walking past in the street. We never quite realise who our neighbours truly are. And don't get me wrong, for the most part, they're good, decent human beings. But this came out of the blue. And there's still no explanation for it. There's still no reasoning behind this tragedy. It's senseless. Yes, there's some notoriety associated with what this killer did. I suppose it's synonymous with the name Sandy Hook, that there was somebody who did something even more grotesque that cost even more lives. That means that even when you think about this killer, the notoriety is not what he would have wished to achieve if that was his aim. Because Adam Lanza takes that, doesn't he? So what was it that drove this young man, this student who was great and on the honour roll, this young man who had the prowess sporting-wise, to feel so much rage that he externalised it in such a horrific way? That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.